And Workforce Development Committee will come to order. A couple of bills here. I don't see the proponents of 3106, so we're going to do a couple housekeeping measures here. And a bill that we looked at last week and didn't have the fiscal work in. It's 2029. Let me open up a work session on House Bill 2029. A quick summary to refresh us.
Okay. House Bill 2029 requires transfer of student education records to the school district when a charter school is terminated or dissolved. Applies student education records statutes to public charter schools. Declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2011.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2029 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Pass the A engrossed measure.
Senator Morris moves House Bill 2029 A engrossed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Morris, would you like to carry this bill?
Would be fine.
Our 3106 crew.
Are you here for 3106?
Okay. Okay. Let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 3106, a continuation from last week. If you could remind us with a summary.
3106A requires school districts to give priority for participation in expanded options program to eligible at-risk students if the school district has met credit hour cap or if the credit hour cap has not been exceeded. At-risk students who participate in the accelerated college credit programs are not required to make payment for participation. It eliminates waiver of duration being the length of the program.
Okay. Jessica Willis, Angela Newsom, come on up. Welcome.
So my name is Jessica. I was a student at Centennial Learning Center, an alternative high school that offered expanded options. A little bit of background about me. I was expelled my freshman and sophomore year at a different high school due to drug-related charges, and that's why I went to Centennial Learning Center. And I don't think I really foresaw a future in myself at that point. But going to the school and having the opportunity to take the take classes at the college really kind of motivated me and encouraged me to get back on track. And I feel like the teachers and expanded options really helped. So my junior year, I started taking classes at Mount Hood Community College through expanded options. I think I got A's in both of the classes I took. And then my senior year, I was full-time at Mount Hood through expanded options and just really could start to see myself as a college student and doing something with my life. And I graduated from high school in 2009, and now I'm currently at Portland State University. I'm a junior going for social work because I feel like the program kind of inspired me because it was something that was helpful in my life, and I want to give back to other youth that might have been struggling.
Okay, thank you.
My name is Angela Newsom, and when Jessica Willis was a junior and a senior, I was coordinating the college preparatory programs at Centennial Learning Center. And during the 2008-2009 school year, that was the one school year that Centennial Learning Center had the benefit of using expanded options. The year after that, the school district applied for and received the waiver. So in 2008-2009, I had the privilege of working with over 30 students at CLC who took college classes while in high school. And I saw students transform before my very eyes in ways that no other program that I administered at this, in the school did it, because suddenly we weren't just talking about college as an option, it was college as a reality, because they were going to college classes and coming back and sharing with their peers in the school building, oh, you know, I was in my Writing 121 class and the professor said this, or oh my gosh, I have all this homework I have to do, college is hard, you know, it really became real. And not only did it alter the lives of the students who actually took the college classes, but in a small school setting, it altered the dynamic in the school when you have that many students who are out of the building coming back and telling their stories of college. So my support of this program is based in my own experience watching students reap the benefits of it, and also recognizing that it's an opportunity that needs to be more widely given to students, and specifically for students who are underrepresented in higher education. So students who are identified by Oregon statutes as at risk. These are students who haven't grown up in family or maybe neighborhood environments where the norm is college. This is a way for students to develop the norm of college by receiving assistance to do that while they're in high school, and that learning the tricks of the trade of college, learning how to navigate the system while you still are nestled within a school that where you know your teachers and you have deep relationships. If I can fall down in college while I have close relationships with high school teachers, they can help teach me the skills I need in college. If I fall down in college and I haven't yet developed those networks of support in college, I'm going to drop out. In particular, if I'm the first in my family to go, or I don't feel like I have the support systems that I need in my community or in my family or in my neighborhood. So I can't speak loudly enough about the benefits of this program and the need for there to be the revision that requires school districts to really focus their energy on students identified as at risk and tightening up the waiver so that school districts really have to demonstrate that they're serving the needs of at-risk students. Thank you.
Thank you. Give us a composite student that you're talking about in high school. You talk about at-risk kids, kids on the fringes, and how this might better address the problem that we're seeing now.
Okay. When I was at Centennial Learning Center, I have since transitioned over to Roosevelt High School, but at Centennial Learning Center, the majority of students who were there had experienced some kind of distress at the regular high school. Either they had been expelled, they were truant, just not going, or they were not achieving quality grades, or they just didn't feel like they fit in. Those were all the different kind of risk factors that they had when they came into Centennial Learning Center. Almost 100% of students were the first in their family to pursue a four-year degree, and about 70% of students at CLC were classified as low income. So the students that I was working with were really students for whom college was not the norm, and they didn't know the systems and structures around it, nor did they necessarily believe that it was an option for them. College was something that you did if you were a 4.0 student, not if you were a student who was in alternative school. And that was a mindset that many students had. And this program, because, again, they were on the college campus, they were able to begin developing that college identity that wasn't developed when they were younger. And what I've, you know, said to other people is that I grew up in a very educated family where it was the norm for me. Since I was very small, I knew I was going to college. So I had that college identity prior to graduating high school. For students that isn't the norm, some work has to be done to develop the college identity. And I saw that work happening when we got the kids to the college campus. They could experience it, they could come back, and they could reflect with me on what they experienced and what it meant and what was easy and what was hard and how do I navigate, how do I talk to my professor? How do I navigate through this so I don't just give up? And I think in particular, again, for students that don't have that norm, that's where the transformation happens. For a kid who it's the norm, it's a great benefit. They can earn some extra credits. They can start accelerated in college, but they're not crafting their college identity. They already have it. For at-risk students, it's an integral part of crafting that identity, and I haven't seen it crafted through any other mechanism when I've been working with students around college preparation.
How will this bill give you some more tools to better do that?
Well, I think the main purpose of this, and myself and Jessica and Labora, another young lady who wasn't able to come today because her daughter is sick, we were part of the revision recommendation process because the need to specify is one of the issues that I know districts are facing, that they are more inclined to apply for a waiver if they can open it, or if they have to open it up to everyone. Whereas if they can specify and say, this is really a program targeting our at-risk students, our students who need more support, then they can say our funds are going to support the kids who are at highest need. And I think that also gives more room to engage in conversations around multiple funding streams as well. If I can talk to a funder and say this program is targeting students who are underrepresented in higher education with the specific intent to increase the likelihood that low-income, first-generation students of color go to and complete college, that's more persuasive around getting community-based support as well. And I've experienced that after our school district applied for and received a waiver for the program. I ran around looking for other funding, and a foundation has provided funding to pay for college classes since Centennial received the waiver. And they did it because I said the goal of this program at Centennial Learning Center is to launch underrepresented students to and through college.
Senator George.
Thank you very much for coming. I'm unfamiliar with this cap. So are we bumping into schools that have hit their cap on the number of credits they can do under this statute?
When you say bumping into, what do you mean?
Well, I mean, basically what this does is waives the it basically prioritizes at-risk students. So are there schools that are basically hitting the maximum number of students eligible, so that's why we have to prioritize these kids? I mean, is that what's happening?
I don't feel equipped to answer that on behalf of other districts. I know that isn't what was happening in the Centennial School District. It wasn't in the Centennial School District.
Okay.
I was told that in Portland Public Schools, that was one of the primary reasons why they applied for the waiver, was because they could not target. And I currently work with one of the women who previously administered expanded options in PPS, and that's what she told me, that if they could have targeted, then they would have kept it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Other questions?
I do, Mr. Chair, and I'm curious if this has been resolved. The April 5 fiscal impact statement, states the measure requires that school districts that have not reached the credit hour cap must ensure, that's the language, at-risk students are allowed to participate and may allow not-at-risk students to participate. The intent of the measure requiring that school districts must ensure at-risk students are allowed to participate is unclear and may be subject to interpretation by individual school districts regarding the extent of ensuring at-risk students are allowed to participate. And I'm wondering, has that been resolved, that concern that's raised by Delapo?
I don't believe anything has changed because we don't have an amendment. Do we, Linda?
We do not.
Your thoughts on that question?
I think it's the legislative intent with the testimony and what has been said that it would be geared toward at-risk, even though it is not specific. It does show with the language.
I'm wondering if it might be worthwhile for Linda to close the loop back with John Turpin to ask specifically what language is of concern to him.
Do that.
If he might have some recommendations. If the bill needs more work, that's basically the question.
Senator Morse, if I understand, you're worried about this being a mandate, correct? An unfunded mandate?
It seems that LFO is looking at this as being unclear what it means, ensure. And is that a mandate? How would it be interpreted by school?
Great.
When I read that, just to say it's difficult to know, to find all the at-risk kids in any environment, even though there is a pretty clear definition. So, we have time. Senator Shields?
Was that a question?
Yeah. You have a concern?
No.
I'm ready to go.
Senator Morris, would you like to hold off?
Well, I would like to have, because, I mean, we have these people review these for, you know, another set of eyes. If there is a concern and something that could be clarified now, it would prevent a problem later on, at least to have a day to look at it and bring it back.
Okay. Thank you both.
Lori?
Lori? Come on.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For your record, I was a little, this is Lori Wimmer representing Oregon Education Association. I was ambivalent about taking extra time if you have a large agenda, but I just wanted to put on the record that the Oregon Education Association does support this bill as written, and we've worked very carefully on this issue for a number of years with a wide array of parties, including the associated industries, the education community, a number of people, to craft two prior versions of the bill and then this fix that makes it clear that at-risk kids are supposed to be at the head of the line when there is a scarcity environment. And we'd sure hate to see further changes, because this is a very carefully negotiated bill, and we've all worked on it for many years together. And we think this is an improvement, but I'm not sure that it needs further amendment. So we'd love to see you move the bill.
Well, thank you. I'm not sure we'd amend it. We just to get a comfort level
clarification
person.
With the fiscal.
Yeah, I'd concerned. Like to know what his issues were.
Okay.
Senator George.
Lori, just because I'm not familiar with this area, can you explain to me the public policy purpose of basically establishing the cap and then moving these kids to the front of the line rather than just exempting them from the cap? What's the public policy thing? So you see, with me, what you do, you want to keep the structure for everybody, but if these kids need to be addressed, it seems like to me that you wouldn't throw them in with the general population. You would exempt them from any kind of cap and say this is something that these kids always qualify. So what's the public purpose? What's the public policy there, and why is that moving like that?
Mr. Chair and Senator George, the reason was that we are dealing with a scarcity environment, and so within existing resources, without adding a huge fiscal burden, what is it that we can do to put these kids at the front of the line so that instead of, let's say, District A has an AP program that would qualify so that they wouldn't actually have to offer this program because it would be another form of dual credit course that they could offer instead. Sometimes the demographics of the students who would elect those programs and would come in first would preclude then there being enough slots open with the existing resources available for those at-risk kids. And so we thought that that wasn't fair and was something that needed to be fixed. That's how this bill for this session emerged. The way the cap emerged initially, again, was about if we're imposing a new mandate on school districts, it ought to be very carefully thought through and limited. Now, districts may exceed it, and some do, but it wouldn't be a requirement beyond that cap.
I guess the only question, and this may be for the department, Lori, and not for you, but just how many kids are we talking about here? I mean, this is long-term policy, and just sometime when those of you may have the answers. I'm trying to figure out, it seems like to me that this is a group of kids where we need to carve them out and say whatever they need, we do for them, and it doesn't affect the cap situation over here for AP kids. Do you see what I'm saying? Because then what they're doing is competing for resources when really we have a program, and then these at-risk kids, they need to be moved to the top. Maybe not; they're not the most qualified for it, but they would benefit the most from it. So I'd like to know kind of the fiscal movings of all this and why that is.
Mr. Chair and Senator George, I can't give you what the total number is, but I can tell you that by moving them to the head of the line in front of the AP student, in my example, we are, with the existing resources, putting them first so that they do get those services. So that's precisely what happens under this bill.
Yeah, but then we bump the AP kids off the
mantle.
Well, I mean, we could, and I guess my question is that we've got two groups that we're trying to, they're two totally different reasons why we have a program, but they're being lumped into one program. And maybe just those of you who are involved in this, I don't want to get in the way of this bill, but
thanks.
It would be really helpful from my perspective to understand that a little bit better.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, well, we have time. We can hold this over until Thursday and get some questions answered.
So I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3106. Jessica, Angela, thank you for coming.
And where did my order go here?
Let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 2282. Linda?
2282 requires residential facilities to ensure that children who reside in the facility receive appropriate educational services, declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2011.
Okay.
Cindy.
We have Cindy Hunt from the department. Bob, do you want to come up as well? Bob, do you want to go?
Cindy Hunt, Oregon Department of Education. As to House Bill 2282, I'm just here to provide information. I believe what the bill does is it requires that for those facilities that are licensed through mainly Department of Human Services, that they would need to, the DHS would need to ensure that those facilities have a standard education that meets rules and so forth available to the kids. I know that Linda posed, a couple of questions about this, so if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer those from our perspective. We're neutral on that bill, mainly because the long-term care and treatment program, which you'll hear, I think, more about with 2281. For those kids in that program who are state-placed and we provide an education, we already ensure that those kids get a standard education. So we don't see this bill as, like, affecting our program over here. So with that, if there's any questions, I'll let.
Well,
okay. Sure. Members of the committee, I testified on this bill last week. This disability rights organization is in support of the bill. Just to clarify that residential treatment and care facilities have an obligation to assure that the residents who are children are receiving an appropriate education. We think this bill would make that statement. And it's a good bill. It should pass.
Okay. Questions?
What would be the cost to the residential?
On 2282, you have the sheet.
Residential. So what would be the cost to them? Has that been factored in?
Chair Hass, Senator Morse, I don't have that particular information in front of me. I'm not sure that it was included in the fiscal. We did not have that information when we submitted the fiscal impact on this bill. I believe we submitted a zero fiscal on the bill
to LFO. No expenditure impact.
Yeah.
There's no expenditure impact on the
state.
On the fiscal.
Additional.
Or local. State or local. But I'm wondering where the residential voice is.
Mm-hmm. With what?
The residential facilities folks would be impacted by this bill.
Cindy?
Chair Hass, Senator Morse, I am not sure what their position is on the bill, and I'm turning to Bob here. I don't recall them testifying in the House as to the bill. So I don't really want to speak for them as far as their issue.
Chair House, Senator Morrison, I don't have any additional information.
When the Legislative Fiscal Office wrote their summary, they did say that it is current practice, and this is merely codifying what is currently in practice. That's probably why they did not, because they all have agreements with the local school districts or the educational service districts to provide education for their residents, and so this is just stating it.
It's a statement.
It is. It's a statement in the law to what's already being done.
Is the bill necessary?
Is the bill necessary?
Uh, Senator Haase.
Brought by the House Committee. House Education Committee.
I'm sorry?
It was brought by the House Education Committee. So
As I testified last week, Senator Haase, what I understand is that issues have come up that are being addressed, perhaps, in House Bill 2281. And in those circumstances, there have been children who have not received adequate education services. And so my understanding is that since there are cases in which that does occur, that it is felt that having a statement in statute that just made that clear would be helpful.
So, is it necessary? Maybe not. Is it helpful? Probably.
Expands the little, maybe a little more clarity the statutes. So I don't have a problem with that.
I'm going to close a public hearing on 2282 and open up a work session on 2282. Any more?
See, this has not been engrossed, has it?
No.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2282 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves House Bill 2282 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Shields, would you like to rage against the machine?
I would be happy to.
Carry the
fight the power.
Okay. Now, a little thornier issue here.
Are you closing the work session?
I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2281 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2282.
No, opposite. I'm sorry.
Amend that? We're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2281.
Correct.
Give us a summary.
Certainly. House Bill 2281 requires the Department of Education to be responsible for the payment of cost of education of students in residential treatment programs by contracting with school districts in which the program is located. Makes the school district in which the residential treatment program is located responsible for identifying qualifying students and providing the educational services to all children in the program, regardless of what entity placed them in the program. Declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2011.
Thank you. And since you're getting handed a new fiscal report, mm-hmm. which is about $1.9 million for the biennium.
Chair Haase is actually indeterminate, and I can speak to that as far as to the whys, but so how about if I provide general information about the bill?
Why don't you do that?
Yeah.
So we can get it in context.
So then you'll,
first.
Yeah. So Cindy Hunt, Oregon Department of Education. Right now, under current law, the Oregon Health Authority and the Oregon Youth Authority contract with residential treatment programs that are licensed through them to place youth in these facilities. Primarily, when they place the students in the facilities, it's because the students have mental illness issues or emotional disturbance issues, and really they're placing them there for mental health treatment as opposed to an educational purpose. Right now, for those kids who are placed there by state agencies, those kids are part of what we call the Long-Term Care and Treatment Program, LTCT. And the school district where the facility is located is responsible for the education, but the Department of Education is responsible under state law for paying for it through a series of contracts. And so what the bill does, though, is that right now the department is only responsible for paying for state-placed kids. But there's two other groups of kids also in these facilities. The first group would be kids placed by school districts. Sometimes a school district determines that in order for a kid to get an education, they need to go to one of these facilities. In that case, the district pays for that placement specifically. out of their existing state school fund dollars and that kind of thing. But there's a third group of kids, and that's the group that the bill addresses. Those are kids who are placed there privately by their parents. Their parents have withdrawn the child from their public school setting and decided that for their particular child that they need this kind of a residential treatment facility. The kids that are in these facilities can range anywhere from, you know, being there for 7 days up to a year. So sometimes it can be a relatively long period of time. So where the issue that this bill came up from is that Chair Gelser over in the House side of things called together a work group in the interim. The Department of Ed participated. I believe, Bob, you participated as well, as along with some other folks, to try to address the issue of, because we were hearing from our contractors that we literally had kids who were state placed that were sitting in a classroom next to the kids who were privately placed. And our contractors were being provided money to educate the state-placed kids, but not these guys over here. And so that was very frustrating for a number of folks, because the responsibility for the education of the privately placed kids is on the parents, it's on the treatment facilities. Sometimes insurance pays for the education, but sometimes insurance has already, you know, the limits have been met and that kind of a thing. So as we discussed the issue over the interim, 2281 is the result of that. And so what would happen under 2281 is that if the kids are placed by the state or privately placed, they would all be part of the LTCT program, and their education would be paid for through that program by the Department of Education. Now, getting to the fiscal impact. When this bill was originally heard in the House, it was in the first week of session. When we prepare fiscal impact statements, we do so based on the governor's budget and the best available information that we have at the time. At that point, although the governor had announced, you know, the large picture of the budget, we didn't have the details down to the level of this particular program. So since that time period, we got some additional pieces of information. Originally in the House, we had a zero fiscal on the bill because the program, frankly, was expected to get more money. We didn't have as much data, and also we also did not have the impacts of the governor's budget on the Oregon Youth Authority. So we reissued a new fiscal on March 31st because of these pieces. One of the impacts on the program is that the Oregon Youth Authority is expected to reduce the numbers of beds and release some students into the community. Approximately 60 of those students, it's estimated, may be placed in these LTCT programs. That's under the governor's budget. Now, the legislature has restored some of that, but we don't have the information yet on that. So as we were looking at how many slots were available across the state, there's roughly between 50 to 75 for whether it's privately placed or state placed. We believe that there's going to be 60 OYA kids, and so if they fill all the slots, this bill that addresses privately placed kids will not have a fiscal impact, because there will be no privately placed kids because the slots are all filled with OYA kids. But if there's some lesser number, we looked at the total capacity, you know, slots versus the licensed capacity, and that's that growth of 60, we get to 1.9 million. Which is, you know, how much the 60 would cost. And so that's why we turned in an indeterminate fiscal, and why this bill now, I think, has a referral to Ways and Means, so it can be part of the larger discussion regarding the Oregon Youth Authority, this program, how many kids are coming from that, how many kids that this bill, you know, would net, and that kind of thing.
So there's only a fiscal in case those slots aren't filled up, in which case it's still not even a fiscal, because that money would be spent anyway, even if those slots were filled.
Correct.
This is not this bill, but there's a policy issue I'm interested in, is when the parents on their own decide to put their child in this, are there any rules governing how that works?
Chair Haas, I don't believe there's any rules per se, other than, you know, the parents with make that decision. I'm sure it's a very difficult decision, because these are residential placements. The kids are living in these facilities, and they have know, mental health and emotional disturbance issues. As a population with these kids, I believe most, if not all, of these kids will be either receiving special education or on 504 disability kinds of plans. But as far as, you know, rules with the parents, no, I'm very hesitant to say parent choice, because I think when you have a child in this situation, I'm not sure how much choice you have. But it's a parent decision, I think, is better to say.
That surprised me, because I know a lot of specialists often come into schools and they want their child to be diagnosed as with needs or disabilities for all kinds of reasons that don't have to do with the child: insurance, school placement, instructional care, or somebody on the Asperger's syndrome. And parents aren't always the best judge of this to determine this. So that was why I asked. But I do agree with your point that this should be dealt with down to ways and means from a policy issue on the money part. So, Bob, do you want to add to this discussion? Or
Mr. Chair, I'm Bob Junda from Disability Rights Oregon. As a general matter, our organization generally works hard to keep people as well as children out of institutional settings. And so we're not interested in creating any greater incentives to allow children to be placed or inappropriately in an institutional setting. However, in the cases that we've come into contact with, where we've received complaints, the children have needed this level of service, and really the only difference between them and their counterparts who are coming in through state placements is that their parents have insurance. And you can end up in the situation in which the child who has exactly the same needs, and to get into a inpatient mental health setting for a child in Oregon is a difficult matter. There are not a lot of resources. And so those kids really are in the exact same posture in terms of their treatment needs as those other children. But the provider of services, of inpatient services, is now in a situation where they do have an obligation to make sure that child gets education, as our other bill would restate, and yet there's no funding available for it unless the parents somehow are able to, in addition to all the expenses that they've gone to already, are able to come up with yet additional resources out of their pocket for education services, which is a tall order. And it can fall upon the provider to come up with something, which is why we've seen situations in which staff members are essentially tutoring children when they have no background in education. But it's a sort of a stopgap measure. So it's a difficult problem. It's one that needs to be addressed. We understand that there's a fiscal issue, and it may be appropriate to go to Ways and Means. But right now we have very vulnerable children who are suffering as a result of this odd funding tie-up. So that's why we're supporting this bill.
Okay. Any questions, concerns, Senator Morris?
Thank you. What happens if House Bill 2282 passes and this bill does not?
Well, again, Senator Haas, Senator Morris, we believe that 2282 really restates the obligation that schools have. We think it may give those schools some extra leverage in terms of appealing to the Department of Education and others to give them assistance in fulfilling their obligations. But again, it's our view that it really restates their existing obligation.
Other questions? Okay. A motion to send this to Ways and Means.
Work session.
No. We're going to close a public hearing on House Bill 2281 and open up a work session on House Bill 2281.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2281 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee for the due-pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves that House Bill 2281 be referred to Ways and Means with a due-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. We'll go down to Ways Ways and Means with a do-pass recommendation.
And?
Ends our business for the day.
Correct.
Thank you, committee. We are adjourned.